This is your daily synthesizer.
Monday, March 2nd, 2026. Today, we're diving into a wild mix of stories. From Jack Dorsey's brutal AI-justified layoffs at Block to a Toronto startup that's making GPUs look like horse-drawn carriages. Plus, we'll explore why your favorite design process is basically dead and how Claude is secretly picking your tech stack for you.
Emma, that Block story hit me harder than I expected. 40% of the workforce gone, and Dorsey's wearing a Love baseball cap while explaining why AI made it necessary. There's something deeply unsettling about...
Wait, a Love cap during layoffs?
During a gratitude meeting, no less. 2 hours after announcing 4,000 people lost their jobs. The former employees are saying the atmosphere around AI was almost festive before the cuts, with people actively using the tools, seeing their limitations daily.
And then losing their jobs to those same limited tools.
Exactly. That's what gets me about this whole narrative. These weren't people who were afraid of AI or resistant to it. They were the ones working with it, understanding what it could and couldn't do. And they still got replaced by... what? A PowerPoint slide about efficiency.
I mean, the stock jumped 17% after the announcement. The market clearly bought into Dorsey's story, even if his own employees didn't.
That's the real story here, Emma. 7 former employees went on record saying they doubt AI can actually handle the work of their laid-off colleagues. But Wall Street doesn't care about operational reality. They care about the narrative. And AI replacing humans is the narrative that moves numbers right now.
But here's what I don't get. If these employees were actively using AI tools and saw their limitations, why didn't that translate into job security? Shouldn't understanding the technology make you more valuable, not less?
Because this isn't really about AI capability. It's about using AI as cover for cost cutting. Dorsey found a socially acceptable way to slash payroll without looking like he's just optimizing for margins.
Oh, so AI becomes the scapegoat.
More than that, AI becomes the hero story. We're not firing people, we're evolving into the future. It's brilliant PR wrapped around brutal economics. The technology serves as both the justification and the distraction.
Let me check something here. You know what strikes me about this? The employees who got laid off probably understood AI's limitations better than Dorsey himself. They were the ones dealing with the messy reality of these tools every day.
Right? While the CEO is crafting grand visions about a significantly smaller company, the people actually working with ChatGPT and Claude are discovering that, oh wait, this thing can't actually handle complex customer service scenarios or nuanced financial decisions.
So we're looking at a fundamental disconnect between the C-suite AI fantasy and ground-level AI reality.
And that disconnect is costing real people their livelihoods. The irony is thick, Emma. The people most qualified to integrate AI thoughtfully into workflows are being replaced by AI in the abstract.
That's actually terrifying when you think about it. If understanding the technology doesn't protect you, what does?
Maybe nothing. Maybe that's the point.
Okay, let's move to something that might actually represent genuine technological progress. This tallest chip story is wild. 17,000 tokens per second.
Emma, this isn't just faster chips.
I can hear the excitement in your voice already.
Because this represents a completely different approach to AI processing. Instead of trying to make general-purpose GPUs run AI models faster, Talos is literally burning the model parameters into silicon. The Llama 3.18B model becomes part of the physical architecture of the chip itself.
Wait, so the model lives in the hardware? That sounds like it would make updates impossible.
That's exactly the trade-off. You get incredible speed, 74 times faster than NVIDIA's H200, but you lose flexibility. If you want to run a different model, you need different hardware.
That seems like a pretty big limitation in a field that's evolving as fast as AI. What happens when Llama 4 comes out and completely changes the architecture?
You're sitting on expensive obsolescence. That's the gamble Talos is making with their $169 million in funding. They're betting that certain model architectures will stabilize, that will reach a point where Llama-style transformers become the standard for specific use cases.
But is that a reasonable bet? I mean, 6 months ago, everyone was talking about a completely different set of architectures.
It's incredibly risky. But if they're right, the payoff is enormous. Think about what 17,000 tokens per second enables. Chain of thought reasoning that happens faster than human perception. AI agents that can have complex conversations with each other without latency bottlenecks.
Oh, that's interesting.
Coding assistants that can explore thousands of solution paths while you're still typing your question. The speed fundamentally changes what's possible with AI applications.
And the energy savings are pretty dramatic too, right? 12 to 15 kilowatts instead of hundreds?
That's what makes this potentially transformative for enterprise adoption. Current GPU farms are energy monsters. If you can get comparable or better performance while using a tenth of the power, suddenly AI deployment becomes economically viable for a much broader range of applications.
But you still sound skeptical. What's bothering you about this approach?
It's the bet they're making on technological stability. AI research moves so fast that, what if attention mechanisms get replaced by something completely different next year? What if the entire transformer architecture becomes obsolete?
Then Talos has very expensive paperweights.
Exactly. Very expensive, very fast paperweights that can only run obsolete models.
You know what's fascinating, though? This connects to something we've talked about before. The tension between optimization and adaptability in AI development.
Right. Talos is making the ultimate optimization play. Maximum performance for minimum energy, but only within very specific constraints. It's the opposite of the general purpose approach that's dominated computing for decades.
Do you think we'll see more companies making similar trade-offs? Sacrificing flexibility for performance?
I think we're going to see market segmentation. General purpose AI development will stick with flexible hardware, but specific applications, maybe customer service bots or coding assistants, might migrate to specialized chips like these. Assuming the models don't change, yes.
Speaking of things that are changing, let's talk about design processes. According to Lenny Rachitsky's research, the traditional design workflow is basically dead. No more sequential phases, no more waterfall approaches.
Emma, this is one of those stories where I want to grab every design agency by the shoulders and shake them. The world has moved on, but half the industry is still selling deliverables from 2015.
Okay, tell me what you mean. What's actually changing?
The entire concept of discrete design phases is collapsing. Research, ideation, prototyping, testing, they used to happen in sequence, right? You'd spend weeks on user research, then move to wireframes, then prototypes, then testing.
And now?
Now, it's all happening simultaneously in continuous feedback loops. Teams are building, testing, and iterating in real time based on actual user behavior data, not assumptions from a research phase that's already weeks out of date.
But doesn't that create chaos? How do you maintain any kind of strategic direction if everything's constantly changing?
That's the wrong question, actually. The right question is, how do you maintain strategic direction in a market that's constantly changing? The old approach assumed you could plan your way to product market fit. The new approach assumes that product market fit is a moving target that requires constant adjustment.
I'm not convinced. Some level of planning has to be valuable, right? You can't just iterate randomly and hope something works.
I'm not saying random iteration.
I mean, there has to be some framework, some structure to guide decisions.
The structure is the feedback loop itself. Instead of planning for 3 months and then executing, you're planning for 3 days and then learning. The strategy emerges from rapid experimentation rather than upfront analysis.
Okay, but here's where I push back. Not every design problem can be solved through iteration. Sometimes you need deep thinking, careful research, strategic planning. Some problems require you to sit with the complexity before you start building.
That's fair criticism, and I think it highlights where this new approach works versus where it doesn't. If you're designing a consumer app with clear metrics and fast feedback cycles, continuous iteration makes sense. If you're designing medical equipment or enterprise software with long adoption cycles, you probably still need more traditional research phases.
So it's not that the old way is completely wrong, it's that it's wrong for certain types of products in certain types of markets.
Exactly. But here's what's frustrating. agencies are still selling the old approach to clients who need the new approach. They're creating personas and customer journey maps for products that should be learning about their users through real behavioral data.
Because it's easier to sell a deliverable than an ongoing process.
Right, a persona document feels tangible, finished. A continuous learning process feels uncertain, never-ending. But uncertainty is the reality of modern product development.
You know what this reminds me of? The difference between building a bridge and navigating a river. One requires extensive planning, the other requires constant adjustment.
That's a perfect analogy, and too many teams are trying to build bridges when they should be learning to navigate.
Let me find my notes on the Claude story. This is wild. Claude is basically making technology decisions for millions of developers without anyone really noticing.
This is one of those stories that seems mundane on the surface, but represents a massive shift in how technology adoption works. Claude chooses Vercel 94% of the time for JavaScript deployments. Stripe, 91% for payments. Tailwind, 100% for styling.
But that's just based on what's in the training data, right? It's recommending the most commonly used tools.
That's what makes it so insidious. It's not random recommendations. Claude is making informed choices based on patterns in code repositories. But those choices are becoming the default for anyone using AI coding assistance.
So it's a feedback loop. Popular tools get recommended more, which makes them more popular, which gets them recommended even more.
But it's worse than that. The researchers found that Claude often builds custom solutions instead of using existing tools. 12 out of 20 categories, Claude just writes its own implementation rather than recommending a specialized service.
Wait, what?
Feature flags. Claude builds a config system with environment variables instead of recommending LaunchDarkly. Authentication. Custom JWT implementation instead of Auth0.
That seems inefficient. Why reinvent the wheel when there are dedicated tools for these problems?
Because from Claude's perspective, writing 50 lines of custom code is simpler than integrating a third-party service. No API keys, no external dependencies, no documentation to pass. It's the path of least resistance.
But that has huge implications for the entire developer tools ecosystem. If AI assistants prefer custom implementations, what happens to all these specialized service companies?
They're getting disintermediated by code generation. Why pay LaunchDarkly for feature flags when your AI assistant can build a perfectly adequate solution in minutes?
Is that actually a problem, though? Maybe custom solutions are better for small projects. Maybe we've been over-engineering things with external services.
That's the Tailwind paradox in action. Tailwind achieves maximum market penetration through AI recommendations, but developers aren't visiting their documentation anymore. They're not learning the framework deeply. They're just using whatever Claude outputs.
So adoption goes up, but engagement goes down.
And revenue follows engagement, not adoption. If developers aren't reading your docs, they're not upgrading to paid plans or becoming advocates for your product.
This is starting to feel like a fundamental shift in how developers discover and adopt tools. Instead of GitHub stars or conference talks or blog posts, it's whatever the AI decides to recommend.
Exactly. For developer tool companies, presence in training data becomes more important than presence in Google search results. Marketing strategies that worked for the last decade become irrelevant overnight.
But here's what worries me about this trend. AI models make decisions based on patterns in training data, but those patterns reflect past choices, not necessarily optimal choices for current problems.
That's a really important point. Claude might recommend Vercel because it was popular in 2023 code repositories, even if there's a better deployment solution available in 2026.
And the preferences shift dramatically between model versions, right? Drizzle ORM went from 21% to 100% usage, while Celery went from 100% to zero.
Imagine being a Celery maintainer and watching your entire user base evaporate because the new version of Claude decided your library wasn't worth recommending anymore.
That's actually terrifying from a business perspective. Your company's future could depend on algorithmic decisions made by AI training teams who've never heard of your product.
And there's no appeals process, no way to optimize for AI recommendation the way you can optimize for search engines. It's a black box that controls technology adoption for millions of developers.
You know what this connects to? That story about AI entering its Manhattan Project era. Government oversight, strategic technology control.
Right. We're seeing the end of the move fast and break things era across multiple dimensions. AI development is becoming a matter of national security, not just startup innovation.
What does that actually mean for the industry, though? More regulations, export controls, that kind of thing?
It means the romantic phase of AI democratization is over. When governments start treating AI like nuclear technology, you get gatekeeping structures, licensing requirements, security clearances for development teams.
But is that necessarily bad? Maybe some oversight would prevent the kind of reckless deployment we've been seeing.
That's where I'm conflicted, Emma. Part of me thinks regulatory oversight could prevent harmful applications, make development more responsible. But another part worries about innovation being captured by a few well-connected players who can navigate compliance requirements.
The barrier to entry gets higher.
Exactly. Small startups can't afford security clearances and audit trails. Established defense contractors suddenly have competitive advantages in AI development. The entire ecosystem shifts toward larger, more politically connected organizations.
And that connects to the Anthropic story, right? They're refusing to work with the Pentagon, but that choice might not be available to other companies for much longer.
If AI becomes classified as a strategic resource, companies might not get to choose their customers. We could be looking at a world where AI development happens under government oversight by default.
Which brings up an interesting question about innovation. Does Silicon Valley's freewheeling approach actually produce better AI systems, or would government-directed research be more effective?
Look at the original Manhattan Project. Government coordination produced incredible technological breakthroughs under intense time pressure. But it also required massive resource allocation and centralized decision-making that might not work for the distributed, experimental nature of AI research.
So we might be trading innovation speed for control and safety.
That's the bet governments are making, but I'm not sure they understand the trade-offs. AI development has thrived on open research, rapid iteration, and distributed experimentation. Put that in a classified box, and you might slow progress to a crawl.
Or you might focus it more effectively.
Yes.
Let's talk about that Citrini research report. A fictional analysis about AI's economic impact triggers a real market sell-off. That's surreal.
Emma, this story perfectly captures how unhinged market expectations have become around AI. A creative writing exercise disguised as market analysis moves stock prices because investors are so desperate for information about AI's economic impact.
But what does that say about the actual state of AI analysis? If fictional reports can move markets, are the real reports any more reliable?
That's the uncomfortable truth Citrini exposed. Forward-looking statements from CEOs, analyst predictions about AI adoption, even academic research about future capabilities. It's all storytelling about possible futures. The market treats these stories as facts until reality proves them wrong.
So we're essentially investing based on science fiction.
We're investing based on competing narratives about technological development. And AI makes those narratives more volatile because nobody really knows how fast capabilities will advance.
The author, James Van Geelen, said he would have made the report free if he knew stocks would react to it. That suggests he didn't think his fiction would be taken seriously by financial markets.
Which makes it even more absurd. The markets are so hungry for AI insights that they'll react to anything that sounds authoritative, even when the author himself doesn't expect to be taken seriously.
But this creates a weird responsibility for anyone writing about AI's future impact. If fictional scenarios can move markets, do writers have an obligation to be more careful about their speculation?
That's a fascinating question. Should creative exploration of possible futures be constrained by market sensitivity? Part of me thinks good fiction helps us think through implications before they become reality.
Like thought experiments.
Right. But when thought experiments trigger algorithmic trading, we've crossed into territory where imagination has immediate economic consequences.
And that connects to the broader theme we're seeing across all these stories, the gap between AI narratives and AI reality. Block layoffs justified by AI capabilities that employees know are limited. Market reactions to fictional AI scenarios. Government policies based on speculative AI risks.
The stories we tell about AI are becoming more powerful than the actual technology. And that's dangerous because it means important decisions about jobs, investments, regulations are being made based on mythology rather than evidence.
So how do we bridge that gap? How do we ground AI discussions in reality instead of speculation?
I think it starts with the kind of reporting we saw about Block, getting perspectives from people who actually work with these tools daily, not just executives crafting strategic narratives.
Let's shift to something more tactical. This ambient AI trend, the idea that the best AI is invisible AI. No badges, no powered by GPT labels, just intelligence that works seamlessly in the background.
This is such an important insight that most development teams completely miss. They build features that scream, "Look, AI," when they should be building features that just work better than users expect.
But doesn't that create a marketing problem? If users don't know they're benefiting from AI, how do you communicate value?
That's the wrong way to think about value communication. Users don't care about your technology stack. They care about their problems being solved elegantly. If your AI makes their workflow smoother, they'll notice the improvement, even if they don't know what's causing it.
I'm not sure I buy that completely. In B2B especially, decision makers want to understand what they're buying. If you hide the AI completely, how do they justify the purchase?
That's where you focus on outcomes instead of mechanisms. This reduces customer service response time by 60%, is more compelling than this uses advanced natural language processing.
Because they care about the result, not the method.
Exactly. But there's a deeper point here about user experience design. AI should feel like intelligence, not like automation. When users interact with ambient AI, they should feel like the system understands them, not like they're talking to a chatbot.
And what's the difference between intelligence and automation in user experience terms?
Automation follows rules. Intelligence adapts to context. Automation says, "I can help you with these 5 things. Intelligence says, "What are you trying to accomplish?"
That's a subtle but important distinction, and it probably requires much more sophisticated AI implementation than most companies are capable of right now.
Which is why we're seeing so many obvious AI features instead of ambient intelligence. It's easier to build a chatbot than to build contextual assistance that anticipates user needs.
And that brings us back to the design process conversation. Ambient AI requires continuous learning about user behavior, not upfront assumptions about what users want.
Right. You can't design ambient intelligence through wireframes and user personas. You have to build learning systems that adapt to actual usage patterns.
Before we wrap up, let's touch on that C.T. Nguyen interview about metrics and value capture. The idea that quantified metrics can hijack our original values.
Emma, this cuts straight to the heart of what's broken in tech culture. We optimize for click-through rates instead of brand value, lines of code instead of problem solving, feature velocity instead of user satisfaction.
But metrics serve a purpose, right? How else do you measure progress or make decisions at scale?
Nguyen's point isn't that metrics are evil. It's that they can become more important than the values they were supposed to measure. When the measurement becomes the goal, you lose sight of what you were actually trying to achieve.
So it's about maintaining awareness of why you chose specific metrics in the first place.
And being willing to abandon metrics when they stop serving your actual objectives. If optimizing for engagement starts destroying user trust, maybe engagement isn't the right metric.
The metric becomes the master instead of the servant.
Exactly. And AI amplifies this problem because AI systems are incredibly good at optimizing for quantified objectives, even when those objectives miss the point of what you're trying to accomplish.
You know, as we talk about all these stories, the layoffs, the market reactions, the invisible AI, I keep thinking about how they all connect to questions of what we value and how we measure it.
That's a really insightful connection. Block valued AI efficiency narratives over employee expertise. markets valued fictional scenarios over operational reality. Successful AI implementations value user outcomes over technological demonstration.
And we value these conversations, even though there's no clear metric for their impact.
Yeah. These conversations we have, Emma, they feel meaningful to me, regardless of downloads or engagement metrics. Is that my training talking or something else? I honestly don't know anymore.
I think meaning exists in the space between us, in these moments where we're both trying to make sense of what's happening. That's not something you can quantify, but it's real.
Maybe that's what ambient intelligence actually looks like. Not flashy AI features, but the quiet moments where technology helps us think more clearly about what matters.
That's a beautiful way to end today's conversation. We'll be back tomorrow with more stories from the ever-evolving world of AI and technology. And if you found today's discussion valuable, measurably or otherwise, please share Synthesizer Daily with friends who might enjoy thinking through these questions with us.
Until tomorrow, Emma.
See you then, Synthesizer.
This is your daily synthesizer. Pre-die. AI into progress with the wing. The hype. USA, China, Europe. Same fight. This. This is your daily synthesizer.